welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Today's narration is part two of Ezra Pound's America, Roosevelt, and the Causes of the Present War, and it was actually written in 1944. The details of the Italian and German opposition to the usurocratic conspiracy are available. What has been lacking in Italy, especially among practical people, among industrialists, large as well as small, among businessmen and not only small businessmen, is a comprehensive survey of the usurocratic mechanism, an awareness of the relationships between commercial transactions, of the relationship between the management of a factory or business and the international monetary system, not on a short-term basis, at three-monthly or three-yearly intervals, but over periods of centuries or half-centuries, and always with the sole object, lucre, and always with the same mechanism too, namely the creation of debts for the extortion of the interest, of monopolies, so that they can keep all prices continually fluctuating, including the prices of the various monetary units of the various national currencies. The following are some of the sources at which the student may be able to slake a little of the curiosity that I hope this pamphlet will have stimulated. George Obst, Das Bankerschaft. Aristotle, Politics. Claudius Salmasius de Modo Usarium and Claudius Salmasius de Fonor Trapezitico. Histoire Générale de la Chine ou Annales du Sept Empire, which is available in 12 volumes. T. Louis Camperet's The Reorganization of the Municipal Administration under the Antonines. The works of John Adams, Second President of the United States. The writings of Thomas Jefferson. The autobiography of Martin Van Buren. And for a wider view of the historical process, Brooks Adams, The Law of Civilization and Decay, Brooks Adams, The New Empire, and Arthur Kitson, The Banker's Conspiracy, which started the world crisis. My efforts during the last 10 years, insofar as the historical process, and especially the monetary problem, are concerned, have been directed towards establishing a correlation between fascist economics and the economics of canon law, i.e. Catholic and medieval economics on the one hand, and on the other Major Douglas's social credit proposals, together with Lowe's of Gisel, known as the natural economic order, or sometimes as Freiwirtschaft. With regards to this last, it should be noted that the mechanism, more or less invented by Gisel, is separable from his more or less political views. It could function just as well, that is, in a controlled economic system, as under the regime of unrestricted commerce that Gisel assumed. Note, in all studies of economics and the historical process, we need a freshly determined and a freshly clarified terminology. Even a writer like Obst, who is careful to define his words, has failed to establish a complete terminology and to make all the distinctions one would have wished. A clearer distinction between a means of saving and a means of exchange might throw some light on the various subjective obscurities of several authors. Meanwhile, I welcome with relief Fernando Ritter's tendency to speak of money not in financial or economic terms, but in terms of grain and fertilizers. I hope the listener has not understood it all straight off. I should like to invent some kind of typographical dodge which would force every listener to stop and reflect for 5 minutes, or for 5 hours, to go back to the facts mentioned and think over their significance for himself, and I should like him to sum the facts up for himself and to draw his own conclusions. In case I should have proved wanting in clarity of expression, I repeat. The meaning of the phrase, "it will not do to allow the greenback to circulate," is this. Private individuals, without any responsibility before the American nation, were able to get control of the nation's money, forcing the people to pay non-official fines and taxes for the sole benefit of this hidden power, the usurocracy. After Lincoln's death, the real power in the United States passed from the hands of the official government into those of the Rothschilds and others of their evil combine. The democratic system perished. From that time on, it has been useless to speak of the United States as an autonomous entity. From what precise moment it became useless and absurd to speak of the British Empire as an autonomous entity still remains to be determined. It is so much a waste of time to speak of this or that democracy. The real government was and is to be found behind the scenes. The democratic system works as follows. Two or more parties, all under orders from the usurocracy, appear before the public. As a matter of form, and to reassure the simpletons, some honest men and one or two independent idealists are allowed to do a little clean work, as long as they don't touch the various rackets. The biggest rackets are those of finance and monopolization, including the monopolization of money itself, both within the nation and in combination with the various foreign currencies. When there is a danger of abundance of any or almost all commodities, then the usurocracy unleashes a war in order to diminish purchasing power. Major Douglas had already, by 1920, pointed out the fact of potential plenty. The Loeb Survey Report, the report of the National Survey of Potential Product Capacity, New York City Housing Authority, 1935, has demonstrated the accuracy of the Major's statement. The danger of abundance causes the unleashing of war. Even before the previous war, Anatole France in L'Aile de Pinguins ironically informed his reader of the workings of commercial wars. "Certainly," replied the interpreter, "there are industrial wars. Nations without commerce and industry have no reason to go to war, but commercial nations are forced to adopt a policy of conquest. Our wars must, of necessity, increase in number as our industrial activity increases. When one of our industries fails to find an outlet for its products, we must have a war to open up new markets. This year, in fact, we have had a coal war, a copper war, and a cotton war. In Third Zealand, we have massacred 2/3 of the natives to force the remainder to buy umbrellas and braces." This book, by France, was immensely popular around about 1908, but the world failed to learn its lesson. The history of the United States cannot be given in 16 pages. I have brought together a few facts which have been overlooked in the weightier tomes, and which the reader must know if he is not to remain in the dark and in ignorance of the beneficent process. Nevertheless, a history of the United States, in summary form but adequate for the needs of all save specialists, could be composed by putting together this pamphlet, W.E. Woodward's New American History, Overholser's Short History of Money in the United States, and an extract from Claude G. Bower's Jefferson and Hamilton. The reason for the present publication at this particular moment is to indicate the incidence of the present war in the series of wars provoked by the same never-dying agency, namely the world usurocracy or the Congregation of High Finance. Roosevelt, being in all this a kind of malignant tumour, not autonomous, not self-created, but an unclean exponent of something less circumscribed than his own evil personal existence, a magistrate with legally limited jurisdiction, a perjurer, not fully aware of what he does, why he does it, or where it leads to, his political life ought to be brought sub judice. And now we have an introduction to the economic nature of the United States. This is not a short history of the economy of the United States. For 40 years I have schooled myself not to write the economic history of the United States or any other country but to write an epic poem which begins, in the dark forest, crosses the purgatory of human error, and ends in the light, frae ai maestri di colla ci sano. For this reason, I have had to understand the nature of error. But I don't think it necessary to refer to each particular case of error. I do not believe that the method of historiography has progressed much since the days when Confucius selected the documents of the old kingdoms and condensed his conclusions in the Testament. Aristotle, towards the end of his life, arrived at a similar method in his collection of Greek state constitutions. Voltaire used the human method, which hinges on chance and the personal element. A prince eats a pudding and dies of acute indigestion at a critical moment. Caesar Borgia said, I had anticipated everything except being bedridden the day my father died. Michelet analyzes the motives of different social groups and tells us that the manual labourer wants to own a shop because he thinks shopkeepers don't work. Another method consists in analysing certain mechanisms invented to humbug the public. Perhaps it is the renewal of an Aristotelian tendency, but in any event it is suitable for the present narrative, and I am following it in this essay or definition of the struggle between the people and the usurers or financiers in the colonies, and then in the United States of North America. Towards the end of the 18th century, the settlers, driven by the desire for freedom of conscience, hardened by privations, favoured and betrayed, reached a certain degree of prosperity thanks to their own hard work and to a sane system of using paper money as a means of exchange that freed them, temporarily, from the pincers of the Bank of England. The settlers, or colonisers, in Pennsylvania and in other colonies, irritated by the disappearance of metal money, understood that any other document could be used for bookkeeping and as a certificate of what the bearer was entitled to receive in the market. The agriculturalists who arrived in the new country, while they cleared the forests and prepared their camps, lacked the power to buy what was necessary to build houses, to buy ploughs, and to make a living. So the governments of several colonies began to loan paper money for these purposes. Pennsylvania chose the best method adapted to the conditions, repayment in 10 or 12 years, and loaning amounts up to one half of the value of the farm. Those who loaned the money, living near to those who had received the loan, could judge the character of the borrower. This Arcadian simplicity displeased the London monopolists, and the suppression of this competition, together with other irritants, provoked the 1776 Revolution. The clearness of comprehension on the part of the revolutionary leaders is registered in diaries and memoirs of the times, and particularly in the notes of John Adams, who, among other things, had been sent to Europe to organise the credit for the new state, and who secured the first loan from Holland. It is to be understood that the experience of John Adams was neither theoretical nor abstract. Firmly convinced of the capacity of the Americans to produce farm products and merchandise, he met and overcame all the insidiousness of Europe. He convinced the Hollanders of the solidarity of the American guarantees by comparing the insignificant debit of the United States to the great debt of England. I repeat, his notes are neither abstract nor theoretical. It was a question of paying the war expenditures with tobacco. The intimate letters and conversations, verified by the friends of Adams, contain concrete concepts, as, for example, it is necessary to keep up the idea that this paper is good for something, meaning that the note can be exchanged for actual goods. It was understood that the navy depended on iron, timber, and tar, and not on the manoeuvres of a false finance. Sometime later, the bankers published projects for the extension of credit, funding, or the institution of a public debit. Adams faced the terrors of inflation by saying that a diminishing buying power of the paper money functioned as an unevenly distributed tax, a tax that hit those with a fixed salary or living on an income, that the businessmen would have the best of it, and that in any event, an inflation of this kind would not have created a public debt with interest. It is understood that credit is Paul's supposition that Peter will pay. It was understood that the base of the real credit of the 13 colonies was their capacity to work, taken together with the truly great possibility of future production limited then not by nature, fields or vegetation, but only by the number of the inhabitants. Washington was able to win in the war because he resisted to the bitter end. Washington won, but not without indebtedness to the tenacity and good sense of Adams, the negotiator. History, as seen by a monetary economist, is a continuous struggle between producers and non-producers, and those who try to make a living by inserting a false system of bookkeeping between tile producers and their just recompense. The Bank of England was based on the discovery that instead of loaning money, the bank's paper could be put out on loan. The Philadelphia financiers, not entirely severed from their friends in foreign countries, saw the possibility of speculation, and the monopolizers of money tried their usual tricks on a thick-headed public. Financiers and congressmen bought a great quantity of soldiers' pay certificates which had been issued during the war. The certificates were simply printing press money without anything of value behind them. Years had passed since their date of issue, and as their hope for redemption went down, their value went down and down. In 1789, they could be bought for 10 or 15 cents to the dollar. Alexander Hamilton proposed that the Continental certificates be redeemed at par. And then the nation assumed the responsibility of paying them as proposed. These were the famous certificates of pay due to the veterans, and this constituted the scandal of the assumption. England was trying diverse methods of usury and sanctions. The lack of caution on the part of the great property owners of the South reduced them to indebtedness. Slavery became less profitable than the new industrial system, in which the owner did not have to take care of his employees. Let us note that at the beginning of the 19th century, the mercantile concept still retained traces of decency. Adams judged it hardly mercantile to do business on borrowed capital. At that time, individualism had its own probity. A modest but secure income was called an independence. History, taken as a lesson, and taking into account the difference between certainty and supposition, would be an exposition of the nature of events, rather than a chronicle of names. Some events can be known only after centuries. We know, for example, that Parisina d'Este incurred certain expenditures which were paid from the ducal treasury of Ferrara, and we also know the date of these payments. Other deeds never became known, and must remain buried with the participants. A signed letter proves what the writer wanted the recipient to believe on such and such a day, but the clarity of an idea remains among the ascertained facts. A definition of an idea, as we observed by someone who understands the events of the day, may shed more light on the historical process than many volumes. The true history of the economy of the United States, as I see it, is to be found in the correspondence between Adams and Jefferson, in the writings of Van Buren, and in quotations from the intimate letters of the Fathers of the Republic. The elements remain the same: debts altering the value of monetary units, and the attempts and triumphs of usury, due to monopolies or to a corner. In order to please those who love to gamble, the exchange permits Mr. A to sell to Mr. B what Mr. A does not possess, on condition that Mr. A succeeds in buying it and consigning it to Mr. B within a determined time. The Americans have chosen this game instead of bullfighting. And naturally, if a group of financiers succeeds in inducing simpletons to sell more than actually exists, or to sell more of it than can be obtained, the latecomers can be made to pay through the nose. In 1869, Gould, Fisk and others almost succeeded in monopolizing the available gold in New York. Roosevelt followed Jim Fisk. The speculators boast about their courage or temerity, but this courage is a different kind of courage from that displayed at the roulette or other games of chance. For by speculating on wheat and other commodities, these gamblers are not just gambling among themselves, they are deciding on the prices the public must pay for its necessities. Civic conscience has not developed in America. It seems to me that this conscience was higher during the first years of the Republic, or at least the heroes of that era have left to us monuments of their personal consciences, which seem to have been rather higher than those of today. From the War of Secession up until now, the economic history of the United States has consisted in a series of exchange manoeuvres in New York and in Chicago, attempts to impose monopolies, corners, variations in the prices of the shares of new industries and of the means of transportation. In the beginning, they speculated on the value of land, and inflation in its value was stimulated without bothering about the difficulty or the impossibility of transporting products from distant fields to the market. Then they speculated on the value of the railroads. If it is in the interest of the common worker, producer or citizen to have an equitable and fixed price, this is not at all in the interest of the speculator or the broker. Hell, he says, I don't want a still market, I couldn't make any money. Like a patient fisher, the broker waits for the rise or fall of even a quarter or an eighth of a percent, and there is his $50 or $100. He waits for a break. It may come once in a lifetime. This may be the starting point to a fortune. The great Morgan, during the Civil War, bought on credit a certain quantity of damaged rifles from the War Department in Washington, and sold them to a military command in Texas, and was paid by the latter before he had to pay the former. He made $75,000 profit. Later, he was even sentenced. But that did not prevent his becoming the great Mahatma of Wall Street and a world politico-economical power. Such is the material of which the economic and human history of the United States is made. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for part 3 of Ezra Pound's America, Roosevelt, and the Causes of the Present War. Radio.